Hello, good afternoon. Dzień dobry. Thanks for inviting me to this festival. Like what I heard and saw so far is very exciting. So I'm very pleased to be able to speak here. Maybe a few introductory comments on my lecture. I'm going to speak about some topics I've been researching into and some work I've done, and in a way like try a little bit like kind of in a little bit like collage like way to trace maybe some trajectories for a political architectural practice. Like critique always needs like a Stein des Anstoßes, you would say in German. I haven't found like a good English translation, but basically a problem. This, in my eyes, is one of these problems, and I have now here a lot of images, mostly from Germany. But I think it's a phenomenon which is much more international. The phenomenon of reconstruction of historical buildings. This is in Braunschweig. This is a new shopping mall, which just has the facade of the old castle. I'm just going back. This I said. Started with the Frauenkirche in Dresden, which was very controversial, because in the debate on the reconstruction, there was as well like a big nationalist attempt of like victimization of Germany for like the war, and that the attacks by the British that destroyed the city weren't necessarily like militarily, and so on and so forth. So it's like. In my eyes, very problematic. Like 50 years after the war, you rebuild these buildings of which is nothing left, basically. And the people, basically, that still know these buildings are already very old. This is Potsdam. This is the new parliament of the Brandenburg state, close to Berlin. And it's now that's now finished. And this is like the masterpiece of them all, the Prussian castle in Berlin that's going to be reconstructed now. Yeah, this is another view. Interesting is like as well like this computer renderings as well. I would like to start really from this image. Here you can see two ruins. In the front you can see the ruins of like the last remains of the castle, the Berlin City Castle, which was heavily damaged during the war and then the remains blown up in 1953 through the East German government. And in the background you can see the remains of the Palast der Republik, which was a kind of multifunctional cultural and political center of the DDR built in the 70s, which was an important symbol of identification for the East German population. As this was how the castle was looking like. This was how it looked like after the war, and this was the palast. And this is how it looked like when it was ruined. Basically, what you can like see here is like an ideological battle that is being fought over buildings. And so, therefore, I would read the ruins of the Palast der Republik first and foremost as a ruin of the socialist project. This leads me to other kind of ruins. This is a partisan memorial in the former Yugoslavia, which was blown up during the civil war by nationalist forces. It used to look like this. This I'm going to show some more pictures of these monuments because they're actually quite peculiar. They're really interesting. They are all war memorials, and mostly they stand on original like battle sites or sites of events, and but these monuments don't really address the horror of the war, the death, the whatever happened there, but it much rather addresses the opposite. It addresses what was fought for, like the kind of future project of a socialist Yugoslavia. I became very much interested in these objects because they seem rather explicitly to mark like a contrast between like a vision that was set out and a reality of today, which basically is quite hopeless in most of the states of former Yugoslavia. Like the economic perspectives are really bad, the scars of the war are still open, and like all this havoc that this nationalist outburst caused, it's in such a it seems to be so far away from the outlook that was there, and I would say in the kind of high phase of the Yugoslav modernist project. I actually stumbled over the monuments because I was interested in architecture. Architecture in former Yugoslavia, especially here in Belgrade, which shares some of the kind of formal boldness of those monuments. This is a school in New Belgrade. This is a housing also in New Belgrade, rocket-like. This is a very interesting typology. It's a shopping center and at the same time a community center. Like it's kind of representing the kind of third way model of Yugoslavia, because on the one hand you had like kind of commercial activity there, a supermarket and cafes, and on the other hand there was a library and a multifunctional hall for the community, and things like a film club, which actually quite interesting, a lot of avant-garde Yugoslav filmmakers met there. And this is the town hall of New Belgrade. And this is the final piece, the Sava Center, which is like a Congress Center, finished when Yugoslavia was almost already crumbling. And this is the TV tower and the Ministry of Defense. Both were bombed during the war in Kosovo. 1999 and are clearly ruined now, but also a lot of other buildings that were housing important institutions or were like important places of identification, like the swimming pool at the Danube, are in a state of disrepair and neglect today. This is how the shopping center looks like. and it has completely lost its function as a community center. Like, there still is like a cafe in there and two or three shops, but all the rest is closed down. Ironically enough, the TV tower has been reconstructed as a kind of a gesture of defiance against the NATO, which, I think is also problematic because the forces behind this reconstruction are mainly like nationalist forces. This is another very interesting case, also in New Belgrade. This is a ruin basically from the beginning. This is the unfinished Museum of the Revolution. I've written a small text about that, and actually, like, I was very much intrigued by that place because I very much like the idea of an unfinished Museum of the Revolution, because I think a finished Museum of the Revolution is not such a good idea, and especially thinking about Yugoslavia, probably the content of that museum would have been like just a kind of representation of the successful partisan struggle. So I think this is like an interesting situation. What I don't like so much about the situation is that it is really abandoned. Like, no one knows about this place anymore. It's totally grown over. And but I think this is a platform that has a lot of potential. Here's the original design by the artist. Got his name. It was not even Wittich, but Wenceslav Richter. He's like one of the Yugoslav modernist avant-garde artists that exhibitioned internationally. Now I'm jumping back to Berlin. This is how Berlin looked like after the war. Very ruined. And this was a situation where, of course, there was a debate about, like, shall we reconstruct our cities or shall we start anew? And of course, the shock was sitting deep, and it was, there was a strong movement for like a new start from scratch, like in the proper modernist tabula rasa spirit. This is a Kollektivplan for Berlin by Scharoun, where you can see like a network of motorways and like large green areas with like large blocks placed freely in them. Also, a little bit later, the Smithsons made a design. There were a lot of different entries to this competition, but I'm showing this here because I'm going to talk more about the Smithsons later. And this was how the kind of structure of the urban fabric of Berlin was looking like before the war, and already before the war, this was kind of an undesired condition, very classically, like this idea of kind of urban slums that needed to be kind of hygienically cleared. This the transition from the dense urban block to the slab, and the consequent post-war building of like mass housing in West Berlin, also in East Berlin, but this is a West Berlin example. This is Märkisches Viertel. Interesting is like that here, this this architecture, which is the result of kind of modernist idealism of good housing for everyone. Actually, in West Berlin, became like a very bad case of corruption. Because West Berlin was so heavily subsidized, and basically they had a lot of money to spend, a lot of people were interested in getting rich. So in this public housing programs, like the companies that were employed to by the city to build these projects, they were paid like far too much money for actually what they did. And in addition, there were like absurd contracts with banks made and developers, which guaranteed them profits for like a really long amount of time, which had to be subsidized by the city. So what you think, this is like kind of prefab mass housing, like prefab because it needs to be cheap in order the rent to be cheap, was actually super expensive waste of money. And here you can still see the motorway planning for West Berlin, which was part of the kind of the same planning. Also very corrupt. And here you can see that in the background you can still see like the dense urban fabric and the new motorway that should go through the city. And this actually was a part of Kreuzberg that wasn't damaged in the war. This kind of development went ahead. But very soon the resistance against this kind of development grew. And those neighborhoods, which actually were there, like Kreuzberg in the 70s, it really looked like a ruin. I mean, the houses were still standing, but they were like so neglected. They didn't have heating. They didn't have like the water system didn't work. Like it was like really in an area where like only the poorest people of Berlin lived at that time. But at the same time, it was cheap housing for a lot of newcomers, young people, students that would come to the city, and that was important for them. So this was basically the reason for resistance against this development, which actually grew and grew, and like because like the conflicts with the city and the police were getting like hotter and hotter. Basically, here you can see a demolition going on of a building with like protest, which in the end actually led to a total change of planning policy in Berlin within like a few years. The old policy of demolition of like old neighborhoods was completely revised, and basically These buildings were kept, and interesting is as well to note the role that architects played in this, because normally architects have this idea of like building, they want to build new houses, but in this development they developed completely new roles, because they often were involved too in these tenant groups, and developed together with the inhabitants plans for the financing, the reconstruction of the buildings, and as well did the planning together with the inhabitants of the renovation of the buildings. And this is how it looks today in Kreuzberg, which is like very lively neighborhood, like almost gentrified. And you have like all this in the whole town of like Berlin, this beautifully renovated turn of the century tenement blocks, which are like now the kind of more expensive housing. But also, obviously, speaking here in Warsaw, other cities were badly destroyed during the Second World War. This is part of London. And this is a vision of the architect couple, Allison and Peter Smithen, that they envisioned for the site. It's called the Golden Lane Housing Project. And the Smithens were the instigators of the famous brutalist movement in Britain. They developed a very interesting position on kind of reviving the spirit of modernism after the Second World War, because they brought in a lot of new, themes for architecture. They were very much interested in everyday culture, in working class culture, in pop art, and as well in they were very much interested in not a tabula rasa idea, but actually in working what is there, working with what is there, and even their housing projects were not intended to replace the old, but kind of to make a new layer over the old structure, and like that is more appropriate for present modern life. And what they tried here in the Golden Lane Housing Project was to implement the idea of the street into a mass housing scheme. They were studying the kind of street life in the working class districts of East London, and based on their observations, they proposed the so-called famous nowadays streets in the sky. This is one of their few realized buildings, where they also could have realize their vision of the streets in the sky. This was already quite late, in the sense of the British public housing scheme, which was revised in the end of the 70s, and because this council social housing blocks became had a very bad image, because similar to the USA, the policy in Britain was to build public housing only for the poorest, and this means like if you build a estate for the poorest of society and they are all there, then of course you have social problems. And then the shortcut was made to make the architects responsible for the social problems. I'm showing here as well like this estate, Robin Hood Gardens, because this is a photo from the early phase, because actually this is now being demolished. This is another photo, and it's very interesting because it indeed looks very brutal, but it is on a very brutal site. You have like three massive streets on each side of the block, like one of them is a motorway, and it's very noisy, it's very like hostile environment, and so and everything you can see there has actually a function, like the fence, the concrete wall around it, that it's going like to the outside on the top. That's like for the noise barrier, and then as well the vertical slabs on the facade. They as well like they're there to break the noise. And then you have like this very quiet green courtyard. And this is how it looked like in 2009. You can already see like the Canary Wharf development encroaching, because this will be the future of the estate. It will be demolished to rebuild the site with higher density by a private developer. And you can see that actually all over East London, you see this old public housing projects being emptied out and waiting for demolition. This is already gone. the largest housing estate within Zone 2. Like in London, you have like the underground, and everything that's within Zone 1 and 2 is considered to be central, and is actually nowadays unaffordable to rent or to buy a house. So actually, it was especially important to have affordable housing in these areas. And this was the largest public housing estate, Elephant and Castle, which was demolished also. Here I would like to read a short passage by Owen Heatherly, where he writes about the current state of the public housing in Britain. A constant danger is that the aesthetic argument can be used as a smokescreen for the political. As so often with such schemes, like here referring to Park Hill, which is another housing estate which is being refurbished at the moment, the beautification of an inner city working class area is achieved by removing its inhabitants. The privatization of one of the century's greatest public projects is covered by a fevered argument. Is it an eyesore? Is it a masterpiece? The question so seldom asked is what the residents think. Regardless of their aesthetic opinions, tenants frequently want to stay in their council flats, and this is precisely the option that isn't on the table. A similar process is enacted all over Britain. The selling off and demolition of public housing is presented as a philanthropic gesture. Because the argument always is, oh, these houses are so inhumane, we need to demolish them. This is another image of the Elephant and Castle estate. This is a very short chapter, but I would say, maybe because the kind of historical chapter was so short also. This is the Nakhonfin communal housing project in Moscow, which is basically a ruin too nowadays. It's like in a state of total neglect. And this was one of the very few communal housing schemes that actually was built in the Soviet Union in the 20s. Before Stalin and Stalinism took over and changed the whole cultural policy. In the early 20s, there were like many very bold designs, like with perspective of a totally new society, and very radical proposals. For here also communal housing, but also there was like research done on the ground, because housing was a huge problem after the revolution, also before, but it was then this problem should have been solved. And here is like some research types for new housing. And the idea of the communal house was not only like to construct a house for a new society and in a new kind of man, but also how to work with the very scarce resources and to still create like a quality housing. This is like here they came up with this kind of like split level designs. And here is the Nakhonfin that I showed before, which was one of the rarely one built by Ginsberg. Now I want to do like a short excursus. This image I found in an art history book on the Russian avant-garde, and it has a very nice title. It's called the attack of the traveling castles of the future on the city of the enemy. This is a drawing from 1916. Unfortunately, in the book, the author of the work is not mentioned. But I think it's like it's quite a nice allegory on modernization. And here I quickly would like to speak about the difference of modernism and modernization. Like, modernization is a process which is very much, I would say, connected to a progressive movement of capital expansion and so consequently of the productive forces. And it has a fundamental destructive aspect, which the scientist of economics, Schumpeter, coined the creative destruction. This process, as we all know, we have all very, I think, ambivalent feelings towards modernization because we like new technologies that make our life easier, but at the same time, with this new technology, there's always something lost. And I would say, like in the combination with like capitalist economy, this process of modernization can be quite violent. And I think this violence is quite well expressed in this image. And modernism, however, I would say it's not to be equated with modernization. It's a reaction towards modernization. It's a cultural and artistic reaction towards that. In the case of architecture, most architecture embraced the possibilities of all the new technologies that were like basically exploding in the beginning of the 20th century. But some were nevertheless also critical towards this, and this mostly like some socialist architects that were asking for like that the new technologies need to be appropriated into the kind of to be useful for the people and not just to create more profit and just for the sake of the new. So Walter Benjamin did a lot of thinking about working a lot with thinking about the term of progress, which is kind of describing like a similar process that I just described. But I would like nevertheless to read a short passage from his thesis on history. The ninth thesis on the Angelus Novus. A clay painting named Angelus Novus shows an angel looking as though he is about to move away from something that he is fixedly contemplating. His eyes are staring, his mouth is open, his wings are spread. This is how one pictures the angel of history. His face is turned toward the past, where we can perceive a chain of events. He sees one single catastrophe which keeps piling wreckage and hurls it in front of his feet. The angel would like to stay, awaken the dead, and make whole what has been smashed. But a storm is blowing in from paradise. It has got caught in his wings with such violence that the angel can no longer close them. The storm irresistibly propels him into the future, to which his back is turned, while the pile of debris before him grows skyward. This storm is what we call progress. now we are back in Berlin. Because these days there's a lot of protest again, like not as hefty as in the 70s and early 80s, but it's growing and it's getting better organized. And actually, it is all concerned with rising rents. And has this time it's about not saving the old tenements, but saving the new old tenements, which are the public housing schemes of the 60s and 70s. Because they are not mostly in danger of demolition, but because many of the public housing companies have been sold off in the 90s and 2000s to generate money for the bankrupt city. Many of these buildings were speculated with, and in combination with the consequences of old corruption, now the rents in these public housing projects are like rising dramatically. Meanwhile, what has the city to do? It is only concerned about its image and developing architecture for the rich. And what is very notably here as well, that it's all with the historic jacket. And that's actually my next chapter, but what is becomes visibly here, that from a movement that started to save the old houses because they were still good to live in, history has become a kind of master plan planning tool. And it actually, like, it really looks like, in reality, like in the renderings, the reality looks like renderings. And here you can see, like, how asocial this architecture is. It's like, it kind of pretending to be like urban architecture, and it's like buildings that like are fronting the street. But actually, it's like they all have just closed gates in the ground floor, there's no shops. And massive swimming pools on the roof. Actually, this is just right next to the castle to be rebuilt. And this is actually the thesis here, that the reconstruction of the castle is not about just reconstructing a historical monument, but actually it is also about reconstructing problematic historical, political, constructions, because the proponents of the Schloss, they always argue it's not about politics, it's just about finishing our grand ensemble, we have lost in the war, and it's not about feudalism doesn't exist anymore, we are democracy today, but actually it's like this new feudal attitudes that you can see very clearly here. This is how the history has turned, how kind of a popular movement in the 70s started to save historical substance, like a bottom-up movement. Now history has become like a tool for top-down planning again in Berlin. And basically, planning is based on the so-called Schwarzpläne, like kind of black and white plans, where you would just mark in black everything that's built up, and in white what's the space in between. which is like a very formal tool, because it's only about the city form and the plan, but it doesn't say anything about the actual qualities a city has, the kind of people that live there, the kind of activities they do there. And so Berlin has been like preoccupied with restoring the pre-war urban grid. And this is the actual like urban plan for the center of Berlin. And now they're even discussing, now you have, you can see in the front the castle to be reconstructed. In the back, nowadays there's a large park under the television tower. And there's a strong pressure from people that have interest in privatizing this area to develop real estate there. And here again, they use history, like the argument that we have to rebuild the middle age street pattern here, because they argue now there's no city there now, but they can't imagine that the park is also a city. And with that, they had like a very strict regulations on new buildings, like a defined height. They did like of the kind of traditional Berlin block, and as well like around that they created like this nationalist discourse on like a typical Berlinish architecture, which actually never existed. It was a construction, a new construction. And the characteristic of this Berlinish architecture is that you have this traditional height of 20 meters, you have like a load bearing facade with holes, like no glass facades, but or other kind of facades. Like stony facades with window holes in them, and you have individual plots. This was like another theme that, like, I mean, of course, there were different actors that had different like interests, but basically, what came out was like a kind of a mashup of all this, which resulted in a very absurd architecture. This is a kind of a super block that was built in the Friedrichstadt. And here it's like a closed building block, but then to get more space realized and for the interest of the investor, setback stories are allowed. And then the buildings have to simulate that they're like individual buildings, but actually it's just one huge block, maybe like this museum here. And the resulting city looks like this, like with like kind of historicizing elements, classical elements, and I think it's that boring idea of a city and has nothing to do with actually what Berlin is and what Berlin could be. Actually, there was a kind of a battle being waged with images in the last 20 years. This is how the East Berlin city center looked like in 1990. You can see the television tower, behind it the park, and then the still standing Palast der Republik, and in the back the foreign ministry of the GDR. Great buildings like this one. This was a restaurant, the Ahornblatt, were quickly demolished. This was the foreign ministry of the GDR was demolished too. And now the images got mixed up. This is like the very boring hotel block they built in place of this Ahornblatt restaurant. And here you can see like one of the first reconstructions after reunification to the right, the white building. This is the seat of the one of the most powerful corporations in Germany, the Bertelsmann Media Group. And on the other side, you see which has become very typical or like a powerful tool in this image war, is that you just erect facades of building. This one is the Schinkelsche Bauakademie, which should be reconstructed as well. But actually, this kind of facade, it's just scaffolding, and then you have the facade printed on the outside. It's already standing there for 20 years, almost now. Yeah, there's one corner they built in brick to give an impression how it could look like. And actually, like reconstruction is nothing new. Already in Berlin, like already the GDR, of course, reconstructed by the, but they reconstructed, of course, selectively. They didn't reconstruct the Prussian castle, which was like a symbol of militarism. And anyway, it wasn't very popular in the Berlin population anyway. But what they did reconstruct is the parts of Berlin that they were like more like connected to Enlightenment and or actually not Enlightenment. Now I forgot his name. the one there was one king that was very popular, and he was considered to be like a reformist and kind of a. He built like this library. It was like the first library that was open like to the public, and a Catholic church. And he was considered to be a liberal and kind of progressive. And so like his buildings, they reconstructed in the GDR, and here you can see a renovation of that building. But this kind of facade you can see here is like you have a like also without buildings behind, and this is the. Already in 1993, at this time they didn't have digital printing, but this was drawn, actually painted by hand, the facade of the castle. Here you can see it finished, and the palace is still standing, and to give an impression of the castle, of the real size, they put a mirror in front of the palace facade so that the castle doubles. The castle facade. So this was powerful techniques in time without digital rendering. And these are the kind of renderings that are being produced the last years. And this is a sample facade. And this is another rendering of the inside. And actually, the point that I want to make here is that this kind of architecture is just—it's all about facades. It's not about any program or content, because with that castle, they had for a very long time the problem they just didn't know what to put inside. And at some point they were coming up with a similar scheme, like in Braunschweig, to have a private developer doing it and having. A kind of a spa hotel and a shopping mall inside, but it was kind of obvious that this was not publicly not feasible, because the public anyway was always quite critical of this Schloss. And so in the end they came up with a construction to put like three cultural institutions inside under the name of the Humboldt Forum, but still these institutions don't really know, like, how to program this building. And when they did the competition for the Schloss, the architect didn't have a spatial program. So the result of the exhibition, the competition, I think it's basically a mirror of the situation. Because the result is like an empty grid. You have the facade, like the kind of Renaissance neoclassical facade of the Schloss, and inside you have like an empty grid for no program. And actually this kind of reconstruction, this is another scheme for Frankfurt where they want to reconstruct the old, like part of the old town. Like this kind of new technologies of rendering, I think they have become really powerful tools, like to create this like imaginary landscapes. But it's really just images. Like even for this project, there's no idea what should be in these buildings. It's just like to build images, and which actually like very much contrasts to the old Palast, der Republik. When it was still standing, there was a intermediary use in there. different cultural actors programmed the building. There were conferences inside and exhibitions and concerts and a lot of different activities, theater plays. Here you can see like an artistic installation. And basically you had a modernist structure that had an open grid, that had a multifunctional, multi-purpose structure, like similar to a fun palace of Cedric Price. Or actually here you can see Rem Koolhaas speaking on reconstruction. This building was demolished in order to build just an image. I propose a rather different kind of reconstruction. It's a work I already did a few years ago, but nevertheless, I think, and kind of my thinking about architecture, it still plays an important role. Instead of building an image, like for no program, I propose to build pure architecture without a program. This is my proposal for a monument for modernism in Berlin. And actually, it was wrongly announced my lecture. It's not a monument to modernity, but it is it's a monument to modernism. And it's a compilation of different modernist architectures, like a collage. But it's not like, it's just taking parts of the buildings. It's not like whole buildings taken, but parts. And the idea is a kind of a modernist Frankenstein. And this is a conceptual collage. This is the development. And it should be like a true modernist structure, like an object in a park. I propose like to have this whole area where the palace was and the Schloss will be, just like to connect it with a large park. Here you can see it standing in the park. And how it comes together with the city, some images, some. And it's existing as a real object, albeit only in scale 1 to 100. And incorporate in this structure are like different projects I studied. This is basically kind of the point that I want to make with this lecture and with my work is because the monument to modernism actually it's a double thing. It's on the, because it's on the one hand, it's a kind of a homage to modernism and to its like the boldness and the kind of like radicality of proposing kind of these new structures, new ways of living, imagining new spaces. But at the same time, it is a monument because it knows about the historicity. Hello. Modernist attitudes and that they're not being too repeated, and also like this this whole notion of architects to solve social or political problems through design, which in my eyes was a failure. But nevertheless, I think there's still a lot of kind of cases like which we can still learn from, and which are like which are just waiting to be actualized in one way or another. And in that sense, I understand this monument as an archive. One part is the Robin Hood Gardens I was speaking already before about. This is the amazing, very beautiful Museum of Modern Art in São Paulo by Lina Bobadi. The masterpiece of this work is actually that its center is just an empty space. It's like an art institution, and its center is an empty space. It's just an empty public space, which is bordering on the one side to one of the biggest avenues of São Paulo, and on the other side you have a overlooking a valley. And this space functions really well. Like in Brazil, like you have huge problems with privatization and rich or middle class people closing themselves off in gated communities, and problems of like security on the streets. But this is one public space in Brazil that actually functions. And it's used for concerts, for, I don't know, political protests, as a meeting point, for baskers making music, as a like lots of different activities. This is one unrealized building. This is Oskar Hansen, probably you all know him, Polish architect. Proposal for Museum of Modern Art in Skopje, which was destroyed by an earthquake in the 60s. And he was, I mean, I could have used other examples like Jona Friedman or Cedric Price too, but I deliberately found the position of Hansen interesting because he was one of the few architects in Team 10 from the Eastern Bloc. And basically here what he proposes is a totally new kind of institution where he proposes to have like kind of movable elements so that the architecture is constantly changing. And he uses this concept of open form contrasting with closed form, and he is kind of, he has like this old mosque, which for him is like this kind of historical monument, and it's static, and next to it the kind of open form and dynamic form of his new art museum. And this one is a communal housing, which is kind of interesting as well, because it was built in the 70s in a kind of council housing scheme, like a mass housing scheme. But within that scheme, there was like one special house that kind of already was informed, inspired of the kind of 70 like social movements to be self-governed. And basically, this is how it looks like. It has lots of different shared flats, like where not like families live alone in their flats, but where many families share one large flat together. And also the whole administration of the house is done by the inhabitants themselves. This is a student housing in Berlin by the totally underrated and quite unknown, at least outside Berlin, architect Ludwig Leo. There was just one beautiful exhibition on him in Berlin, which was closing this weekend. And this is a student housing scheme he did in the early 50s. He worked a lot with basically body measurements, and these rooms are very small, and this is for two people, but he designed it in a way that like a lot of the elements have like several uses. Like you have a bench, which can be a table, and a like kind of a working group situation, and you can sit there and read a book, and same time it's a part of the stairs. And another interesting feature of this thing is that all the two rooms are connected with the bathroom, which you would think that's a strange idea because the bathroom is the most private space, but actually, like, especially because it is like that, he wanted to create, like, he always, like, tries to create, like, this little, like, confrontations in his buildings where people have to come in contact and deal with each other. This is another quite famous example by Hannes Meyer, his constructivist Peterschule design. And I think it's like, why I like this so much is because actually it's like it's a polemic, this thing. I think a lot of people take this too serious because it is totally absurd, but actually it is a reaction on this. There was as well a competition for a site in the old town of Basel to build a school, but actually the site was much too small for the school and they wanted to have a traditionalist design. And what his answer was to lift the whole outside areas, and he like argued it all like with kind of lighting schemes and like just like technologically, but actually I think it's a brilliant critique of the stupid outlines of the competition. It's also something that architects rarely do, that they critique the outlines of competitions, which a lot of the times are already the source for bad architecture. And this is the constructivist theater in Moscow, the Narkomfin, which is, well, like it's like a new kind of institution. It's a theater, but at the same time it's a community center, and where it's designed in a way that a lot of like things can happen in the building simultaneously, and you have various construction of connections of like gaze. And the last but not the least, the Narkomfin communal house, which leads me very last to a build project I've done recently. I don't want to speak too long about it because my colleagues will come in 2 weeks' time and they will speak a lot about the model that's behind this building, the financial model and similar kind of buildings. But just very shortly, this is a communal house for 20 people, one living unit. And on top you have like a huge common space, which is divided in two parts. You have like the communal kitchen of the inhabitants, and then you have a public space in front, which is connected to a stair, with a stair directly to the street. And this building was very cheap, like it did cost only half of the normal building costs in average in Berlin at the moment. And we as well like reused here, like for example, part of the old wall, there were a garage before on that site that now function as a noise barrier. And but it was possible like to build a building how it, like this, because in this kind of process with this other client, you can really like you can discuss many things like differently. You can discuss about standards, and so this was a very, very interesting experience for me doing this work with this group. And in that sense, as well, for me, this is in a way an answer on, like on my own call that I see in the monument, a kind of actualization of like an engaged architecture, but which works with like different methods, doesn't come with like top down approaches, and works closely with the user. Works with conditions you find on site, which I think is a totally different approach dealing with history, not through images and monuments, but actually with like the substance of kind of everyday matter. And here I would like to stop. Thank you.